Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we meet the multi-talented filmmaker, performance artist, actor, and author, Miranda July. July is probably best known for her offbeat films she writes, directs, and often performs in. Me and You and Everyone We Know was the 2005 film which won the Camera d'Or Award at the Cannes Film Festival and the Special Jury Award at Sundance. Her other films include The Future and Joni for Jackie, a film series of shorts by women filmmakers. In addition to her work in film, she's created a number of multimedia performance pieces, including the iOS app Somebody, which allows users to compose a message to be delivered to someone else in person by a third party. As a writer, July is the author of an acclaimed set of short stories, No One Belongs Here More Than You, and her latest project, her first novel, The First Bad Man, published by Scribner. The First Bad Man tells the story of Cheryl Glickman, a middle-aged woman who's somewhat in crisis. She runs a self-defense nonprofit, but she leads a repressed, humdrum, solitary life, although with vivid imagination, until a young, self-absorbed, lazy woman named Clee moves into her ordered life. A home version of Fight Club ensues, which seems to snap Cheryl into living a far richer life. The book is absurdly funny yet emotionally satisfying as her characters become deeply moving through the course of the novel. The name of the book, The First Bad Man, a novel by Miranda July, my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Miranda July, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, glad to be here.
This is a new book, The First Bad Man, your first novel. As I understand it, it started out as somewhat of a completely different story when you sat down writing than what the novel actually became.
Yeah, I initially gave a totally different idea, a much more non-fictional idea. It was a story taken from my life that I was planning on sort of changing and developing. And then what happened was I made my second movie, The Future, long before finishing that version of the novel. And I realized, oh, the great thing about a book is not only am I not acting in it, you know, because I act in my movies, but no one like me, no one with my body type or my background has to be in the story. There's no character, I don't need to play any character in it. And so why limit myself by drawing so much from my own life when actually I feel most kind of agile and honest with truly fictional characters. So at that point, I secretly threw away that first idea and was just kind of waiting for something in this other genre. And I kind of had it clear in my mind. I just needed, like, the specifics.
Yeah. Is your life played a role? Every performance artist I've ever met, their life sort of plays a role in their performance art, but in your films and your short stories, was there any sort of strong autobiographical element, or were you writing like this book?
You know, I mean, everything I've made, yes, has my emotions all the way through it, but I think the distinction, like in my movies, I'm not just in the character that I'm playing, I'm in all the characters, you know. I'm the sweet young woman, but I'm also the creepy old man, you know? And anyone who knows me can see that. So yeah, I'm all through this book, and in some very direct ways too. I mean, the woman in this book becomes a mother. I became a mother while I was writing the book. But I think from the get-go, just having someone who operated in the world so differently from me in a way allows me to be more like emotionally honest.
Now, Cheryl Glickman, the character in this book, main character, she works at a woman's self-defense nonprofit. She's been there a long time. She seems to be very competent. But as far as her life goes, it's almost like she's preparing for death.
That's so interesting, yeah.
I mean, to me, that's you know, she has a small apartment. Everything's in its place so that when they find her body, even though this is never really stated, but this is the subtext I took away from the novel, was that this is a person who's never going to find somebody else in their life, resign themselves to that somewhat, and sort of lives through fantasy and is preparing for the day when it's all over.
That's a good take. I'm glad that came through. Yeah.
So where did this character come from?
Well, I know I would seem to be the opposite of this as someone who's like known for being like highly productive and engaged in the world. But, you know, we all have like our sort of shadow and flip side. And I think there's a part of me that feels like if I don't stay in perpetual motion, I will become Cheryl. Like, I have a side of myself that feels just completely inert and like lazy isn't even the word. Like, I just don't want to move again ever. So I'm so terrified of that that I never am still for a moment. That's not true. But, you know, I think it wasn't hard. I mean, it was like really easy and kind of a relief to make a character like this and to give her, while she may seem sort of, you know, very pathetic from the outside, she has some righteousness and some pride in herself. And to have, to think of those qualities as somehow important rather than just being afraid of them, there was something transformative about that for me.
Right. Cheryl Glickman, this character, she's got a bundle of weird theories, you know. She believes in migrating souls meeting over centuries and long romances through multiple lives. She also has this obsession with a child that continues to show up. But when the book opens, we're seeing her as this very structured person who's been working at this nonprofit, a woman self-defense nonprofit, but really more seemingly concerned with the business side of the nonprofit than actually mission driven. And she's sort of obsessed with a board member, an older board member in her 60s named Philip Bettelheim. And at Philip's urging, she goes to a chromotherapist.
Mm-hmm. A color doctor.
Yes, exactly. A color doctor. In times of stress and any time life really, it's just sort of psychosomatic element when life gets too real, I think. She develops this lump in the throat that she can't swallow. And so she's out to cure it. And, of course, all of her trials to get at the heart of this takes you into sort of that alternative medicine side.
Right. Yeah, and ultimately therapy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she would like to have the ball surgically removed, but unfortunately it's not real.
Yeah. Well, this relationship, and to me, this is what really opens Cheryl up to me as I was reading it. And there's two things that happen in the story. But her relationship with Philip Bettelheim is really enjoyable at the beginning of the book because she longs for this guy. She can't say anything. And finally, he says something. I have a confession to make to you. Why he would make this confession is beyond me, but she gets her hopes up, and then, of course, the confession is something different.
Right.
In fact, he's wanting her permission to have sex with an underage girl that he's in love with. This is a 60. Yes, exactly. And that was one of the more weirder elements of this novel. The novel is really enjoyable. Your sense of imagination just runs riot in this book. And the idea that Philip is going to be texting for continuing permission throughout the book as Cheryl starts to live her life.
Right. I know those texts are kind of like these benchmarks. And it's kind of, I mean, I think that idea, consciously or not, came from, have you ever had an unrequited love and somehow the relationship consisted of them telling you about their relationship with their wife or who they're longing for, and like that was the intimacy between you,
right?
You know?
No, I never have, but
okay, well, that's good for you. I have, definitely not to this extreme, but you know, when you're wishing there was something happening between you and someone and they're like longing for someone else and telling you about it, like it is a weird kind of intimacy. It's almost flirtatious, but it's not really about you.
And in this book, you take that to just well over the top extreme.
Yeah. I know, which was so satisfying.
Yeah, in which they're asking for permission to basically, the probably the euphemism to use on the radio would be to round the diamond.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Well, there's another part of this book that sort of brings Cheryl out of her shell, and that's when her bosses ask a daughter that she had known as a little girl, who's now grown up. She's a 20-year-old blonde bombshell. The book makes that apparent.
Yeah.
Clee, that she's needing a place to work as she goes to find work as an actress. And so Clee moves in, and Clee is the utter opposite of Cheryl, a slob, you know, a sloth, if you will.
Yeah, yeah, and a little bit like not, she's definitely not overthinking everything the way Cheryl is. She might be underthinking.
Now, how did this, give us a sense of how this dynamic added to the novel?
Well, I mean, really the heart of the book becomes Cheryl and Clee's relationship, and which, you know, Clee is like not even really a nice person. Like, she's rude to the point of like rough and physically rough. And so she's a total affront to everything Cheryl's worked so hard to maintain. And she kind of explodes Cheryl's whole life, which should be a disaster, but it isn't. And their relationship transforms again and again so radically that, I mean, I almost thought of it as like different lifetimes, like literally, you know, are they mother and daughter? Are they enemies? Are they, you know, like, I don't want to give too much away, but really they have like, you know, these massive changes that happen very organically over the course of the years of the book. And by the end, Cheryl isn't alone. She's not with Clee, but she's not alone either.
Well, you know, I think it was, you know, Philip Bettelheim for the first 70 pages is telling us that he has this secret he has to tell Cheryl, and Cheryl is getting her hopes up, and then he finally springs it on her after the huge buildup that he is interested in Kirsten, a 16-year-old, and he wants her blessing. That's hit number one. And finally, Clee, who's just taking the order of her little apartment and just, it smells, it's bad, it's, you know, stuff lying around, it's everything that Cheryl isn't. And finally, they have a physical confrontation.
Right.
And instead of, which the irony of her running a woman's self-defense nonprofit is strong there. And out of that comes this, all of a sudden, this awakening of Cheryl. Cheryl comes to life.
Yeah, she starts to fight back. Not that she ever has like a chance against Clee, but it's a huge relief on some like very basic physical level. And she has tons of anger to work with, and the lump starts to go away is the first thing. But it gets a little more complex than that.
It does get complex, and all of a sudden Cheryl and Clee have this relationship themselves of, it's not a squatter and a tenant,
yeah,
which is what it starts out to be, but it's this non-sexual physical relationship of fighting and acting out the self-defense videos this nonprofit turns out.
Right.
But it also becomes mother-daughter. It becomes sort of teacher and student, and both are both at the same time.
Right. Yeah. I don't want to give away the last third of the book, but
yeah,
there's a romance. There's a romance yet to come.
Yeah. Now, Cheryl also has mentioned that she believes in loves that have loved over multiple lifetimes, that souls will migrate. And she has this obsession with a child, and she's starting
right
to see it in every child she sees, or a pregnant woman. She'll be talking to this child, Kubelko Bondi.
Yeah.
which was a great name. And I assume this is the biological clock of some sort.
Yeah, although it began as a child. You know, she met this real baby as a child who she felt this profound connection to, but since she was only 9, it was unclear if this was like her spouse or her child, you know, since mm-hmm. she was a child. And she just kept, I don't know if you have it, but since this book has come out, all kinds of women have told me, like, I have that. I have, like, Kubelko Bondi experiences, which just means where you catch the eye of some other woman's baby usually, and you feel like this weird resonance, like you're connecting with them on some deep level, and maybe you have like a secret bond that's like stronger than what they have with their mother. You just feel that for an instant, and she has that occasionally, not with all babies. She kind of checks to see if it's there. And when it is there, she feels like that's the original baby, but that it's sort of hosted by other babies throughout time.
It's interesting you're hearing people that do that, and I suppose everybody has that moment where they feel like they'll be looking at somebody who's maybe a stranger, and they'll feel like there's a deeper connection, but it's this momentarily fleeting thought that dissipates when, you know, your rational self sort of says, hey, snap out of it.
Yeah.
And Cheryl, you've written this book about this person who just can't seem to get away from that, get that rational message to come through.
Right. She's not like a knowing person. I mean, she gets into all these kind of extreme situations, but she's not like savvy. If you have a romantic dream about a really unlikely person, like, for the first little bit after you wake up, you think, well, maybe they're the one. And then you snap out of it and you're like, oh my God, no, that's so funny that I even felt that for a second, you know. Whereas Cheryl would just sort of stay in the dream. And that was fun because it actually, you know, different things start to happen if you just hang in there and really put your faith into your unconscious, really.
As you were writing the book, you know, the novel takes a long time. It's different than script writing, even right. Different than short stories. It's coming back over weeks and months. Did you ever second guess yourself on some of the, I mean, the book is very funny and at times, and then it's very thought provoking at others, but some of the situations seem to me a little extreme, and yet they work,
right.
But I could see where, for a first novel, it would be difficult to say, you know, to have that courage, that sort of writing courage, just say, okay, here's the story, here it comes.
Yeah. No, I knew I was out on a limb for sure. And the first people I asked to have read the book, like, you know, when it was sort of all there, but still a relatively early draft, were strangers. I went out of my way to find people who weren't even necessarily like fans of my work, you know, like just friends of friends. And because I really needed to know, like, how far out am I? Like, is this going to work, you know, just for like a person, like someone just off the street sort of. And it was, that was a great point because, you know, everyone has their own threshold and not everything held water for everyone. But I began to realize through that process that there was real emotional content. And when I got like notes from these strangers, they said things, you know, they were like, I don't know why that baby thing kind of got me. Like, it's weird, but it got me, you know? So then I would think, okay, like I can handle weird, but I don't want to go so far past that it's only alienating, you know? And it reassured me that there was, you know, I was mining an emotional veins that ran deep enough that in theory I could walk that tightrope, you know, to the end.
My guest today is Miranda July, author, filmmaker, performance artist. Her first novel, which follows up with some highly acclaimed short stories, No One Belongs Here More Than You. Her first novel is titled The First Bad Man, a novel. It's published by Scribner. And is this going to be the future, or are you still continuing to do multiple artistic endeavors where writing, whether it's for film or for page or performance, continues to sort of revolve the three, if you will?
Wow. Yeah, I am still rotating for sure. There's no next novel in the works, but there is a next movie that I'm just starting to write. I even have this app that I'm relaunching in really just like a month or so. So I'm like madly working on that, which couldn't be more different from writing a book.
Well, let's talk about this app. Is this the Somebody app?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, this, as I understand it, this came out of a performance piece, in a way.
Well, not really.
Okay.
I mean, I had the idea for it, and it is very related to a lot of other work, even the book. I mean, the idea that there's something sort of liberating about playing a role was on my mind a lot when I was writing the book, and you know, and then I thought of this app right after I finished the book. But I made a movie. I made a short movie of it called Somebody, in which you sort of see the app in action, as it probably will never be in life. But people use the app to, you know, a woman uses it to break up with her boyfriend, which means that she writes the breakup text. This is how the app works. But instead of it going to her boyfriend, it goes to the Somebody user nearest her boyfriend. And then that person delivers the message, acting it out as her. So in the movie, there's this like big guy breaking up with this little young man. And the big guy is fully, you know, you can write in like it's like a screenplay. You can write in whether you should be crying or how you should act.
Be angry. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
You two-timing, you know.
Right. And you introduce, like, if I was sending you a message, some stranger would come up to you and say, "Rich, it's me, Miranda." But it could be, you know, it wouldn't be me.
Exactly. Have you tried this out? So what's been the reaction?
Well, it was kind of amazing. Like, the reaction to the concept was sort of huge.
I would think anybody who's delivering bad news, this is the way to do it. Somebody do it for you.
I mean, there were people who were like delivering messages on their like morning run, you know, like for a little while there was enough density that you could do that. Like if you lived in an area where there were a lot of users, this guy was being sort of like a Paul Revere, just kind of running around delivering messages. There was a woman I saw who had like a new mom who was kind of stuck with her baby in one of those like backpack carriers, and they were just going out delivering messages. And then the thing is, I'm such a novice with this app stuff, and in a way, the demand for it sort of broke the app. Like it wasn't very sturdy. And so I'm rebuilding it from scratch, and also in a bigger way. It's going to be launched for Android and iPhone, so it should work for everyone.
So we should look for this in about a month.
Yeah, I mean.
So if you have important news that you don't want to deliver in person, wait a month and use the Somebody app.
Yeah. It's a nice way to flirt, too. It doesn't have to be bad news.
Well, yeah, that's the other thing. I mean, bad news is one way to do it, but, you know, you always forget what it's like to put yourself on the line, as Cheryl does at times during this book.
Right.
Cheryl Glickman, the character in The First Bad Man. Well, that sounds really interesting. How did you get involved in designing an app?
Well, I had the idea, and it seems like everyone's making apps, so they must... How hard could it be, was sort of my thinking. And then I like had it sort of priced out by a friend, and it turned out it was really expensive. And, you know, it uses like GPS, and it's very complex. And then wonderfully, Miu Miu, which is Prada, you know, like big designers whose clothes I would love to have, but don't. They invited me as a filmmaker to make a short movie for them, and that I pitched this Somebody movie, the one I told you about, where people are using this seemingly fictional app to deliver messages. But my pitch to Miu Miu was, let's really make it. Let's make the app. Like, you know, it's not for you guys, it's not that much money, and it would be so fun to have it be more than just a movie. And they loved that amazingly. And they've, you know, we've become partners on this since then. And they're great supporters of the arts.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you're getting started back into movie mode as far as writing a script. Has the act of writing a novel helped your script writing at all?
Yes, so much, I have to say. I think...
You know, they're two totally different animals.
Yeah, they are, but, I mean, the main thing is, like, how do you tell a story that people want to keep watching? And I think, in some ways, I feel like The First Bad Man is, like, the best movie I ever made. Like, part of me is frustrated that, like, it... I mean, I'm so glad it's a book and it's done, but it would be a really fun movie to make, too, and I think it kind of opened up what I feel capable of in terms of a movie. So this next project is ambitious in ways that I won't get into.
Well, now I read an account where you said you really don't want it to be a film, The First Bad Man, to be a film. But could you see yourself going back and adapting it at maybe at a later date?
No, only because I already feel like life is so short, and it's too long to spend on one idea, you know. Then it will have ended up being like a decade on one idea, you know. And that's just...
Well, a film can take that long anyway,
right.
Original idea.
Yeah, totally. So I just feel like better to start with something new, you know. I'm a different person than I was when I started writing this. And each project to me is sort of like a dare. So I always want a new territory.
Now, your last film, I think, had a budget of about $1 million. Has what's happened in the interim sort of upped the stakes for this next film?
I don't know. I mean, the film business is its own beast, and you never know quite what the climate is going to be when you go back out there. And for me, it takes so long between films that it's radically different each time. It doesn't look like it's getting better for my kind of film. Theatrically, although at least you can say with confidence now that, like, it's okay that most people are going to watch your movie on their computer. Like, that's not an insult, you know?
Right. Or via one of the streaming services, right?
Right.
Yeah, and I guess computer or your tablet.
Right, right.
Hopefully not on the iPhone, not on the phone.
Yeah, please, just not that. Not on your watch. Yeah.
That's right. Well, congratulations on a great first novel, The First Bad Man. I know there was a conversation you had recently that was written up, and, you know, the adjective is quirky, and I'm not sure if it was you or the person you were talking with who hated that term, but...
Well, it's still a word. You're allowed to use it.
Yeah, I wouldn't say quirky, but just... A little off the wall at times,
yeah.
But it's a wonderful, wonderful read. The First Bad Man is the name of the novel. Miranda July, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Filmmaker, performance artist, actor, and author Miranda July speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her latest project is her first novel, The First Bad Man, a novel by Miranda July. It's published by Scribner. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.